Paranormal and UFO Radio, and I'm welcoming you to the show. Tonight we have with us Sir Clifford, and with our Sunday night special, the Cherokee Medicine Way. And apparently, we never got to do a show last weekend because Clifford had a little accident, didn't you?
Just a bit.
it just goes to show you that spirit walking and driving at the same time don't really work so well, huh? Or, of course, it wasn't your fault, was it? It was theirs.
Well, actually, if you want to get right down to it, I hit her in the rear, so according to Texas law, it's my fault no matter what happened.
Yeah,
and that's fine. You know.
But you had a good time.
Well, I didn't. I had a good time before that, yes.
What I meant, yeah.
Yes.
Do we dare tell anybody what you were doing that day, or you want to...
Well, that weekend we were having a reunion for a unit that I was part of, the Central Intelligence Agency, back in the late 70s and early 80s, and we were a psychological warfare anti-terrorist unit. And so we were getting together again for the first time in 20-some-odd years, and it was great to see everybody.
And did you learn anything new, or did you just kind of like what all took place? You just kind of all just had a big old picnic and got to reacquainted with each other. And
We were going to go out and have a turkey hunt, and you know, had all kinds of crazy weapons and stuff to use, and. And it rained, and so the only turkey we saw was a turkey vulture, and none of us wanted to eat that. So.
Yeah, I hear you there.
But we talked, and we had a good time. It was interesting, because there were some people who were involved in some things that I wasn't aware of. Like, the year before I got involved with that particular program, I was doing an undercover operation on behalf of the Texas Department of Public Safety against the Banditos Outlaws. And one of the guys who was there said, how did you like working undercover against the Banditos? And I told him, well, it was a whole lot more fun after it was over. And he said, well, do you know what happened after it was over? And I told him, yeah, I left Texas so I could stay alive.
and
so he started telling me about how the case went after that, because he was an FBI agent at the time, and he was working that process, and talked about the stash houses, all the drugs and all the illegal weapons and stuff that they were able to confiscate because of the 32 some odd guys who had gotten arrested who gave information. So it was interesting, yeah.
Well, that was a motorcycle gang, wasn't it? Or,
yes, yeah. Yes it was.
Didn't they do a television show on that at one time? Or a movie off that? Somebody else also went undercover?
There have been all kinds of shows about people going undercover in motorcycle gangs and stuff. Mm.
I don't think that would have been one of my favorite jobs. That would have been pretty
risky. It was pretty deadly 24 hours a day. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, here in Madison, Wisconsin is where the CC Riders first started too.
Okay.
I don't know if you know the CC. You've heard of the CC Riders.
Yeah.
Well, actually, they did a song about them, CC Riders. Well, I don't want to sing. I'm tone deaf.
Thank you.
I'm afraid our listeners would quit listening real fast if I started singing. So, anyhow, you had a good time. You got to meet all your old friends and renewed old tactics, military tactics, huh? I guess I'm dying to find out, but I guess this isn't really the proper time and place to talk about it, is it?
Not really.
On the radio show. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
So, tonight we're going to be speaking again on the Cherokee Medicine Way, and I guess it's just going to be a little tidbits here and a little tidbit there. And I ask listeners, if you got any questions, to instant message us through the Yahoo Instant Messenger. You can contact us at Burlington News, or you can call us at 262-767-2864. And we'd be more than happy to take your calls, or I'd be more than happy to take your instant message. So, and in the meantime, we're going to be just talking away here, and you guys can just kind of like kick back and grab yourself something to drink and relax and hear what Clifford has to say on the Cherokee Medicine Way. I have a question for you, though. I just watched, this isn't anything, well, kind, maybe it is something to do with medicine. I guess it would be, in a way, it's blood. I was watching the latest movie tonight with, what the heck is it, Blade. And they said that the origination of Dracula was with Dagon, the Sumerian legends of Dagon.
Well,
have you ever heard that?
Yeah, it's basically true. The folks back in Sumeria had a rather interesting practice, and it wasn't so much about drinking blood. It was actually stealing energy, and most of the stuff that you see when it comes to and this does touch on Cherokee medicine, by the way, so we'll go into it then.
Oh, okay.
We'll probably irritate a lot of people because I'll use a true-to-life deal of an individual who's running around this country who's well-known worldwide. And but anyway, what it amounts
to... Well, that's good. We need to...
You can take parts of people... By eating parts of them or drinking their blood.
Hold on.
You can get energy from that.
Okay, hold on just a second. Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Okay, I'm back. Okay, so go on.
Okay, so you can take other people's energy in various ways. Some people will do it physically by drinking blood or by eating parts of their body or something. And some people, most people do it simply by taking energy. For instance, if you're ever around someone where any time you're around them you feel like you're just being drained, I'm sure you've probably met people like that.
Oh, you betcha.
And there's a real simple thing to do to find out if they're a psychic vampire, which is what you call someone who steals energy. And you can cross your legs, and you can cross your arms, and put your thumb and your middle finger together.
Okay,
thumb and middle finger,
okay,
both hands together, and cross your arms and cross your legs.
Now, is this both hands?
Yeah, both hands.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you do that, and they're a vampire, they're going to lose interest in you in a hurry.
Really? I always wondered how to protect myself from a psychic vampire.
Yeah. Well, I've seen it happen in as little as 2 seconds, that someone will all of a sudden just veer away and start a conversation with someone else. My second wife had a problem like that with her first husband, and we were at a band banquet for my youngest stepdaughter at that time, who was becoming the drum major for the next year. And so, Billy was sitting next to me, and her ex was sitting next to her, and she was just feeling drained, and she's like, how do I get him to shut up? And I said, well, remember what I told you about dealing with vampires? And so I was like, oh, yeah. And immediately she puts her thumb and fingers together, and she crossed her arms and crossed her legs. And it literally took about 2 seconds, and he turned and started just cut off in the middle of the sentence and started talking to this lady across the table because he wasn't getting what he needed anymore. Now, like most people who do this are like him. They do not know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you could tell them, and they just think you were so full that it's not even funny. They wouldn't realize it in a million years. Every once in a while, though, you'll have someone that you can talk to about it. And sometimes they see it. Like, I was teaching a seminar, and there was this lady there, wonderful individual overall, especially now. And just, really, really fine person. She was a registered nurse. She really enjoyed helping people. She was a massage therapist. just loved taking care of people and stuff. But even though she was trying to help these people, they would be drained while she was around. And even though she seemed so nice and personal and stuff, it gets to the point that they would just want to stay away from her. Well, we kind of had a confrontation. We were in about our fourth or fifth seminar, and these were seminars that run from like Friday evening through Sunday, and we would put about 30 hours of teaching in that time. And so, you know, the classes were long anyway and kind of draining in and of itself, but it got to a point where the people in the class just kind of confronted her on this issue, that they just really felt that way around her. And so we talked about it, and what we suggested doing is that you take a stick, and you need it to be a small stick, one that's brittle and one that you can break easy. And I mean, a pencil will do as far as that's concerned, but, you know, just a stick. And so you rub your hands together and get your energy flowing, and you hold that stick in both of your hands, you know, like one on either side, either end of it, and allow the energy to flow into it, and you do it with the intention that when you break the stick, you will break the chain of psychic vampirism in your genetic line. And so this is not only for you, but it's for everyone else in your genetic line. So let's say the psychic vampirism in this particular family started seven generations ago. You know, that person out there, that first generation, could be being reborn or have been reborn already. And so they might be doing it someplace else. And yet, when you break the stick, it gets the whole genetic line. Now, in her case, she had two kids who were into it, too. And so it broke it for her two kids, and it broke it, you know, all the way back. So, however far it went. Now, the you know, we knew for a fact that, you know, her mother and one of her grandparents had this problem, too, and that's probably the chain that went through it. And so, whoever it was, however far back, it was broken for all of them. Now, whether they chose to take it up again or not is up to them. But they had a chance to be free from it. So, just, you break that stick with that intention, and then you burn the stick. You know, and just allow it to be gone. Now, they might choose to take it up again, and sometimes you'll tell them about it, and they'll say, no, I'm not going to do that. Well, do we have something for them, and it ain't nice. What we do is we put a shield around the person, you know, like a sort of a chrome ball, like a mirror inside and out, just a shield around them. And the purpose of the shield is to protect other people from them, that they can, if they shoot out a psychic barb at someone, it just hits the shield and bounces back and nails them. Well, what we do is we run siphons from them to other vampires that we know and back. Now, for instance, there's this particular vampire that's over in southern Louisiana named Lynn. And Lynn is really, really strong. And Lynn just loves it when I hook up other vampires to her. You know, because basically, she depletes them in a hurry, and they learn the lesson. And when they, the thing is that you set up the siphon so that when they do learn the lesson and they're willing to stop it, then the siphons will break so that they aren't becoming a victim. And, you know, so they've been losing energy to others and gaining energy from other vampires and stuff. But once they learn the lesson, the siphons break, and then they're still shielded. They can't do it to anyone else in this lifetime. But then they've also learned their lesson, so they don't want to anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, that way you don't wind up with a karmic debt to that person because you made them become a victim.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the thing. And, you know, so far Lynn survived all of them. I mean, she's still doing her thing. We run, you know, we'll find a vampire that we need to shield and we'll siphon them to her. And she's just the happiest little camper you ever saw. But, you know, whoever you hook her up to, they're not real happy at all. We haven't found anyone strong enough to make Lynn learn that lesson yet. So that's just a way of dealing with it. Now, there are, you know, there. This is where we're going to get into the touchy part of it.
Okay.
In Cherokee medicine, there are, you know, our view of a witch. Now, this is not like someone who's in Celtic witchcraft or something like that in Wicca. You know, Wicca or Witta or any of those types of folk magic or folk religions. And, you know, those people had the name witch put on them by the Christians. You know, because the Christians basically, if there was something that was empowering other than what they did, they would label those people witches and you know, make them outlawed and stuff. And especially if it was women who were powerful and women who knew medicine and that sort of thing. You know, so they were the ones that got it the most, but men would get it too.
Mm-hmm.
And now, interestingly enough, there are some really funny people in the world of Wicca who call men who are witches warlocks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a warlock is anyone, male or female, who would betray their coven to the Inquisition to save their own life. And more often than not, it was men than women. About 99% of the time, it was men instead of women. And therefore, it tended to get applied to men. Well, a warlock, being called a warlock is not an honor, let me tell you. It's about the lowest thing that there is.
Mm-hmm.
In Native medicine, being called a witch, period, is not an honor in any way, shape, or form. It's not like a Wiccan, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A witch in Native America is someone who has been trained to do medicine in a good way, but has chosen to use it for evil.
Mm-hmm.
And in that class of people, we have a number of folks known as raven mockers.
Raven mockers?
Now, raven mockers, yeah. Yeah. Now, there was a lady back around, you know, thousands of years ago when some of the Asaga were first getting, you know, first moving into the what's now the United States and stuff, and who was running around, and basically all the people in that area were considered to be pretty much good people, and you know, they had, you know, little misunderstandings from time to stuff, but there was essentially no evil in the area at the time.
Uh-huh.
This is in what's now the Southeast Woodlands area. But evil came in through a woman who became a raven mocker, and she was known as Spearfinger. And she had a long fingernail on her left ring finger that was extremely thick and extremely sharp. And when she was a little girl, there was fire, and her family was killed, and she was the only one who lived. And instead of understanding that these accidents happen and stuff, she became very bitter and became the first person who was really evil. And what she would do is she found that she could prolong her life by taking someone, preferably the younger the better, and taking her spear finger and cutting out their liver and eating it. And then she would take on their life. Now, see, we see that there are four different souls in the body. There's the higher soul that's up around the head and that extends down into the heart area. And then there's the osseous soul, which is in the bones, and the fleshy soul that's in the blood and radiates out into the tissues and stuff. And then the hepatic soul in the liver. And this, all these souls together, the energy from it makes up a person's aura. Well, the hepatic soul also corresponds pretty closely to, for instance, to what the Chinese would call the Jinxian, which is the prenatal qi, the life of a person, and when it runs out, they die, and it doesn't matter how healthy they are or anything like that. Well, it's kind of the same thing. That's in the liver, and when all the hepatic energy is gone, there's nothing that can sustain your life. So these this raven mocker would go, and she would find some child and capture it, and she would cut out their liver and eat it. And, of course, they died, but she would take on their life. And so there was a time when she had been living for hundreds and hundreds of years, and she had developed quite a, a knowledge of occult lore and stuff, and how to do all sorts of evil spells to draw people to her and to cause different calamities to happen so that she could get at her victims and stuff like that. And she began to kind of get greedy. You know, it used to be that she would do it, and then she'd go away, and nobody would see or hear from her for, 60, 70 years sometimes. And then she'd come back again. But then she started getting greedy, and she started going after more and more people on a regular basis. And it became a problem. And so some of the people went to the Ottawegi and said, okay, this is the problem. You know, she keeps coming down from the north, and she's raiding our people and stuff. You know, what can we do? And so the Ottawegi talked about it, and all the elders talked about it and stuff. And what they decided is they would send people out from the Wolf Clan, who are kind of like the police and the scouts of the Cherokees, the Aniwaga. And they would go out, they would watch for the Ravenmaker. And so when they saw Spearfinger coming, they ran back, and they told the Ottawegi, who then went and found some women who were in their moon time. And it's kind of a funny thing. There are a lot of tribes today, especially the Plains tribes and stuff, the patriarchal tribes, if you want to get right down to it, they say that a woman is unclean when she's in her moon time.
Mm-hmm.
Not so. Actually, that's when a woman is her most powerful. So, you really want to have a great time sometime? Have a sweat lodge where you've got an equal number of men and an equal number of women in it, and all the women are on their moon time. You know, you would get more done in that lodge. It's probably gotten done in thousands of years. I mean, you'll affect all of creation in a major way.
Mm-hmm.
Because the energy is so strong. Well, they sent these women out, seven of them, and the first one kind of fell in behind her and kind of herded her along. And she told this woman, you stay away from me. And so she just kind of laughed and went along behind her and herded Spearfinger on down further into the midst of the Cherokee tribe. And as they went along, then all of a sudden, the second woman joined her, and they kind of flanked her a little bit behind her. And they went along, and they got a third one where they had one behind her and two on either side of her, and they just kept herding her along. And the more they did, the weaker she got. Until finally they had six women around her, and they brought her down to a seventh one, and the energy was so great that she just collapsed. Well, during all the time that they were bringing her down to the seventh woman, the rest of the people had been gathering up all the wood and stuff that they could and making this huge pile, and they put a stake in it, and the seven women pulled her up onto the pile of wood and tied her to the stake, and they should have gagged her, but they didn't. And they lit the pile on fire, and the women just stayed around it to make certain she didn't get off of it. And so as the fire went up, then she started telling people, you know, if you want to do so-and-so to someone, this is what you do. And unfortunately, there were people there who, had a little temptation in their life to get something better for themselves, whether they earned it or not. And so different people basically memorized different spells and stuff that she taught. And that's how evil came with the Cherokee people.
Hmm.
And so that was, that was a rather interesting time, but that's the thing. She was a Ravenmaker. And there are Ravenmakers today, and we've done some in the past several years and stuff. We had a problem with one over around Tahlequah about 10 years ago and dealt with him. And there have been others here and there that we've had to do something to stop. Well, unfortunately, they're... You know what's the best place for darkness to hide? It's in the light.
Uh huh.
And there's a person who is considered to be just absolutely the most phenomenal human being on the face of the earth running around right now. I mean, it's not the new Pope, somebody else. And this person has lived 70 lifetimes.
Who is that?
Well, we'll get there. I'm going to tell you what this person does.
Okay.
You know, before people turn their radios off, I'm going to tell people what this person does.
Okay.
Now, there have been movies made about this and stuff. And what this person does is he and his little inner sanctum will do this special ritual anytime he or they are about to pass on, like they're getting old, and he will go into the body of a child who is just about to be born and force that child's spirit out and take its place and be born. And then when the child gets to be a few years old, then these other people who know where that spirit went will go to that area, and they will go to all the children in that area, and they will show it a bunch of things, some that belong to that person, and some that are either are better or worse in condition than that person's stuff. And invariably the child picks out all the things that are its spirit from that previous life that it stole. And doesn't pick any of the other things, whether they're better or worse or indifferent, you know. Just it only picks out those things that they know belong to that other person. You know who I'm talking about yet?
That lived 70 lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. This one has currently lived 70 lifetimes.
I think, I'm pretty sure I do, and the guy's darn name, because I was thinking about that tonight, and I can't...
There have been three or four movies made about him, and he's known as the Dalai Lama.
Oh, no, that wasn't the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, well, you can go and watch the movies that have been made about him, and sure enough, they go and they show him, take him to the child, and he picks all the stuff.
Yeah.
This person who's just supposedly passed on his head and stuff, and that spirit has gone on and taken the place of another person, basically is taking the body and forcing out that child's spirit. You know, and, you know, they have all sorts of ways of sugarcoating and stuff, but it still comes down to the man's a Ravenmacher.
Really?
Really.
Huh.
You know.
No, and there's not such a thing as a good Ravenmacher.
Well, is there such a thing as a good person who steals another person's life?
No, unless it's already an agreement before that person comes onto the earth plane, such as
well,
you have walk-ins.
Well, there wouldn't be a need to steal it then, now, would there? There wouldn't be any need to force another spirit out.
No.
No.
Well, how do you know that it's being forced out?
Well, because of the things that they have written about it in the past that have come to public light. You know, so it's like people come along to me and they say, "Oh, would you donate so and so to the Dalai Lama?" It's like, I don't think so. You know, would you help free Tibet? Why? So that he can go back and run it? You know.
Hmm.
You know, that's, you know, just can't go there. You know, that's a form of witchcraft by native standards of what a witch is.
Well, there's
are there wonderful people who are lamas, you know, that, you know, from Tibet and stuff? Yeah, they're magnificent. But that's not, you know, that's the vast majority of them are really good people. It's just this one little group that kind of runs everything.
No, and I can't think of his name, and it's been driving me crazy all night too. He would show up, they felt that he was immortal, because they would see him occasionally, you know, in different ages. One was he was with Marie Antoinette before you know, she was beheaded, and because of it, they said that she was beheaded with a smile on her face. And I can't think of his name.
Saint Germain.
Yes.
Saint Germain is not a Raven Mark.
Okay, now because he's an immortal though, right?
Oh, he's a master. Yeah, he's an ascended master.
And so one would not be the same as the other. Okay,
no.
Because with Saint Germain, what he does is he just kind of like disappears because he always looks the same, right?
Yeah, well, he would live. He lived a whole bunch of lifetimes on this earth, and lived right to the point that he died and went into the spirit realm and then came back for another life. And he wasn't one of those kind that was slow about it. Most of us will go into the spirit world. We'll stay there about 1,000 years and then we'll be reborn. He just kept coming back, man. He was on the fast track to learn all the lessons he could as fast as he could.
Yeah, because they would see him 100 years later, and someone would say he looks exactly as he did prior to that. So I was just assuming that he stayed the same age, because.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. No, he lived a bunch of lifetimes, just one right after the other, and learned all the lessons he had to learn, and now has committed himself to stay as an ascended master until every last human has reached mastery.
And now, is Saint Germain a lot walking the earth today?
Saint Germain walks in any dimension he chooses to walk.
Oh, okay, okay.
And, and sometimes he's on the earth as we know it, sometimes he's not.
Okay.
He's on another dimension and stuff, but he doesn't die anymore. He's immortal now.
Okay, so he's past that point.
Yeah.
Okay, he's ascended to the...
He can manifest in a physical body or into a spiritual body, however he chooses to.
Oh, okay. Okay, thus meaning ascended master, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. And then the Dalai Lama is a Raven Mocker.
Right.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, the interesting thing right now with the Dalai Lama is he has chosen to do something different. So in this lifetime, in this incarnation, he's chosen to become something better because he has said at this point that at the end of this life, he will die.
Uh-huh.
In other words, he will pass on to the spirit realm, and he will not move into another person's physical body. So, at the end of his lifetime, at this lifetime, he has, and in his lifetime now, to give him credit where it's due, is he has chosen to not be a Raven Mocker anymore.
Okay.
And see, that's something that's hopeful for all of us. It's a good lesson from the Dalai Lama, okay?
Uh-huh.
Is that if you do evil, you can choose to stop doing evil.
Uh-huh.
And this is a man who's done it for thousands of years, 70 lifetimes. I mean, thousands of years. And has all of a sudden said, I'm not going to do this anymore. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And
that's how come he was able to retain his memory as a child when they would ask him all the questions and he would give them the exact answer that they were looking
for. Right, because he had never stopped a physical life. And you see, your higher soul, that part that's up above your head and comes down into your heart area and
uh-huh,
stuff,
uh-huh.
That's otherwise known as the mind.
Uh-huh.
And that connects between your higher self and your lower self. And so, he just carried that memory from, one body to the other, but he didn't really have 70 lives. He had one life for 70 lifetimes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because, okay, hold on just a second.
Yeah.
Okay. Just a second. My phone's busy tonight, I guess. Okay, so now, any other shocking news before we go on? Dracula.
Well,
okay, so now going back to Dagon, the Sumerian.
Yeah.
Now, according to that blade, that was where vampirism first started. Now, would that be is that then in the Sumerian time, would that be that wouldn't be the starting of the starting of the blood sacrifices, is it?
No, the starting of blood sacrifices was with Prince Satanaku from Sarkhan, which was around
Prince who?
Prince Satanaku. He was a prince of Sarkhan, which Sarkhan is now, you know, where underneath the Pacific Ocean, in, you know, where the northern parts of it are the Hawaiian Islands and the southern part is Easter Island, and all that area was Sarkhan, and that flooded before Mu.
Yeah. Now, and how do you spell Prince? What was his name?
Satanaku. It's S-A-T-A-N. A-K-U.
A-K-U, okay.
And, you know, that's where the name Satan came from.
Uh-huh.
You know, Satanaku actually started the initiations of evil, as they were known, which was first animal sacrifice and drinking of the blood, and then human sacrifice. And, you know, he eventually figured out that he'd really made a terrible mistake, and recanted it and went back to being, you know, an Ottawehi with, you know, or you know, he was, he wasn't really a part of the Asa God, but he was, you know, the counterpart.
Hey, hello? Hey, hello?
Satanaka?
Yeah, but strange, wasn't what happened?
Well, I just heard this really loud static and stuff, and looked at it and said we connected, and I asked your name a couple times, didn't hear anything.
Yeah, I was saying hello, and nothing. It was just like, apparently, I don't know what's going on.
Well, we're having an electrical storm here for
Okay.
Fair possibility that's
going to be a problem. Okay. So then Satanaka recanted.
Yeah, Satanaka recanted and went back to serving the light, you know, working for the White Lodge. And his followers, his former followers, about 20 years later, managed to capture him, and they sacrificed him and drank his blood and ate his flesh. But the interesting thing is that his name has lived on. You know, even though he recanted and said that he was wrong, his name has lived on as being eventually coming about, for instance, in Hebrew, in Ha-Satan, meaning the evil one. So it's kind of a funny thing. People tend to remember the bad that people do. They don't remember the good. Like, the Dalai Lama, you know, is Ravenmacher.
Right.
And for 70 lifetimes, he's done something bad.
Uh-huh.
But now in this time, he's chosen to do something good, mm-hmm. which is to pass on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and get on with doing things in a decent way. So what we should remember is really not that he's done all this bad stuff, but that he has now chosen to do good.
Right.
And what remains to be seen is if he follows through with that or not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, true. Well, circumstances kind of more or less forced him into a humble life, too. Right.
Well, I don't know. He lives pretty good. Yeah.
Well, at one time, you know, when it was all done and over it. No, right now he's living pretty good again.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as far as psychic vampirism goes, I have always felt that because, you know, they have taken people like this to, thinking that it's some sort of a generic thing. They've tested them, maybe thinking it was a chemical imbalance. They've also tested these people for possibly a psychological reason. And these people that I'm talking about are abusers. And I have always felt that the abusive personality is nothing other than a psychic vampire. And that they have got such, they are so addicted to the energy, you know, that they create from the fear, you know, and they feed off of it. And then once they fed off of it, you know, then they say they're sorry and they pamper their victim, you know, or their meal, you know, and, you know, and replenish its energy. And then, you know, and it's just like any other sort of addiction, you can turn around and stay away from it for so long, and then it builds up and builds up, and then you finally have to have another fix. And then,
yeah,
you know, and then they come right after that, and they actually take that one person, like a wife, and they keep that wife, you know, isolated, you know, so that, you know, nobody else can feed off of her energy, keeps her isolated, you know, and builds her up, and then when it comes feeding time, he hits on her, it scares her, beats her, you know, which of course is going to exert as much energy out of her as possible, and then he just
right. They have all this hormone and chemical release, and all that stuff is released, and they feed off of it. Sure.
Yeah, and you know, I'm just so sure that that's what it's all about, because even they, you know, when they take them in and talk to them about, you know, in the, you know, when they take them in for counseling, they'll say, well, why do you do this? And they don't even know themselves, you know. And
yeah, well,
you know,
there are two types of vampires, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the kind that do it willfully, that know what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Like there was, my second wife and I were walking in Riverside Park in Tulsa one day, and this guy came by and just took a swipe at us and just trying to get some energy, and she and I both looked at each other and turned around and nailed him.
Uh-huh.
And he knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew exactly what we did. He didn't like it.
Yeah.
But then there were other people that we would run into who would kind of do that too, but they didn't have a clue as to what was going on.
Yeah.
They simply learned it innately, like when they were children, small children usually, because their parents or grandparents or some babysitter or something like that was doing it to them, and they simply learned how to do it at that young age to survive, and it just got to where it was just an everyday part of life.
Yeah.
They never thought about it.
Yeah.
You know, so you got two kinds.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you find someone who is abusive to someone in a relationship, then, you know, it was done to, you know, they were abused when they were younger or something, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, like a lot of child molesters will say, well, you know, I spent about 6 months counseling all the sex offenders in the Oklahoma County Jail here in Oklahoma City years ago, around 1989, somewhere there. And I lasted 6 months. I was about 3 months longer than anybody else had lasted. And basically, the thing that that these people kept saying is, "Well, you know, well, I can't help it. You know, it was done to me, and so I do it." And you know, that's just the lousiest excuse in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I had a little problem when I was a kid where this guy messed with me, but did I turn it around where I would go out and abuse other kids later on? Oh no.
Yeah.
I turned it around where when I find those people who are doing the abuse, I hurt them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's simply how you choose to deal with it. And that's the thing. It's a choice.
Yeah.
Abusers can choose not to be abusers, or
sure,
they choose to be abusers.
True.
And it's all about choice.
But I still think it's an addiction for that energy. You know, because
they
afterwards
become addicted
that
to it.
Yeah, they become addicted to it, and then they
become addicted.
Yeah,
to it, but originally they had to make the
choice. Well, sure, just like a person does with cigarettes or cocaine or any other type of drug, they have to. You know, initially they choose it for some psychological reason. They choose it, but then I think what they do is they become addicted to that energy. And then they have to feed, and because if you ever watch an abuser, a wife abuser, because you know there are more husbands that abuse wives than wives abuse husbands, but I mean there are wives that do that as well.
That's right.
But the thing is, but I'm going to use the man for this example. But it seems to me that what happens is he will turn around. And when he needs that fix, he'll beat her for no real valid reason, you know.
Right.
And then as soon as it's done and over with, you can just see this quietness that comes over them, and then they'll give their wives flowers and I love yous and everything just to build them back up again, because they don't want to kill them off, because that's their meal. And then what happens with the wife is she turns around and she gets caught up in that cycle too, because her energy is depleted. She will then go to her friends and that and cry. Thus, while she's crying, the people that love her, they end up unknowingly giving her their energy.
That's right.
And thus, she ends up, in the long run, addicted to it as well. Thus, she stays into a relationship that she doesn't even want to be in.
And it doesn't matter if they're actively doing it, like the you know, the beater, or they're passively doing it, like the one who's going and getting it from her friends and stuff. They're both vampires.
Yeah. And then their children turn around and live in that, and they pick up this as well. So then they start testing. It's like a person that lives in an alcoholic family, you know. They eventually pick up that, you know, they eventually start picking up that leftover glass, you know, that they never finished off. Next thing you know, you got an addicted child that carries on into adulthood. So anyhow, I've been talking to people, you know, that have been going through these abusive relationships, and I've been telling them that in like women, is they try to stay in a situation, you know, in even though bad marriage, they, because they don't understand why he's doing it. Okay, so, and they try to convince themselves maybe it's them or something like that, and they keep giving him another chance because of the fact he doesn't know why he's doing this. You know, he has 10,000 different excuses for it. But when the woman starts to understand what it is that he is a feeder, that he's a psychic vampire, and he's feeding off of her. And she's doing the same thing to her friends and teaching her children to eventually do that. It seems like all of a sudden they have an understanding of what's going on, and then they can grasp the problem, and they seem to accept it better, and can step out of the relationship easier.
Let's talk about ways to get people over it.
Yeah, that would be good.
All right, number one, what you don't do is you do not confront a vampire with garlic or with crosses, you know, or holy water. They just laugh their butts off because it doesn't work.
No.
Okay? What does work is doing things like shielding and siphoning them. Another thing that works is doing soul retrievals for their victims. And, you know, soul retrieval is kind of a deadly process, okay?
Yeah.
There is an organization that in this country that teaches lots of people how to do soul retrievals. In fact, the lady that does most of their teaching lives here in New Mexico. She's up in Albuquerque. And what she'll do is they'll have a seminar that teaches someone, you know, a basic little weekend introduction to shamanism. And I'm going to tell you something. A seminar will not make you a shaman or an Ottawehi or whatever else, medicine person, whatever you want to call it. It will not.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can go to seminars and you can learn stuff, but what you need is a teacher who has been in it for many years. You know, a physical teacher, not some spirit out there, but a physical teacher who has been in it for many, many years, who can guide you through the process, because the spirit room is a deadly place. And what these folks will do is sometimes they'll have, you know, maybe a month, 2 months later, they'll have one of these classes on soul retrieval. And this lady teaches classes of about 100 people in a weekend. And everyone gets the soul retrieval, whether they need it or not. You hear what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
And they get it from people who, in many cases, have no experience other than this little weekend workshop they had and, you know, maybe a few weeks or months experience of playing around in the spirit realm. And so they don't know what they're getting into. And the person, and you don't know what they're giving you. So when you go through something like this, then you might wind up with parts of somebody else in place of your own parts, and you might wind up also with something really vicious and evil getting put in you that's just going to really enjoy the ride, and that's called possession.
Yeah.
you know, and then someone has to do a depossession later on. And, you know, I just, you know, I wish this particular foundation would just go away, because the rest of us keep having to clean up their messes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so, you know, but anyway, they do their thing, and it doesn't matter how many times we try to address this with them, they don't want to hear it. There's too much money in what they're doing. You know, you have a class for 100 people at a couple hundred dollars pop.
Well, sure. Know, well, those people are desperate when they...
profit.
Well, when they're going to a seminar like that, you know, they're desperate. You know, something's happened in their lives, and they're willing to pay anything, you know. And
they're either desperate or they're on a power trip, one or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, you know, the thing with soul retrievals, you go into the spirit realm, and you work with spirits that are already involved in that person's life and your own, and they take you to where all the pieces of this other person's souls are. The deadly part is when you find that something in the spirit realm or even in the physical realm has a part of them, and you have to get it back.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it might be a, you know, it could be a place that has it. Excuse me. Someone could have a car wreck and leave a piece of themselves there where the car wreck was at, or actually in the car. Someone could have a pet that dies and then lose a piece of themselves there or something. You know, or they might have a situation like, you know, a friend is sick and they want that friend to be well so bad that they inadvertently give a part of themselves to them. The person gets well and goes on. You know?
Yeah.
You know, which is fine. And those people generally are not going to have any problems at all when you confront their higher self of giving up what they have of that other person. Or, you know, real good, for instance, I worked with a lady who was in New York City when the Twin Towers were hit with those planes. And she was a block away when they fell. And her cousin was in one of them. You know, and she was trying to get to her cousin. Well, this thing starts coming down. She's running as fast as she can. And all this dust is coming and stuff, and she's just absolutely terrified. She wound up under a truck that had big old pieces of masonry and stuff hitting it, just about crushed her, you know, and then getting out and going on. And she would hear songs that never meant a thing to her before. And all of a sudden she'd start crying. You know, in all kinds of songs, different kinds of music she never even listened to because she just didn't like it. And she'd hear this song and just immediately start crying. It was a song that was important to someone else who died.
Really?
Well, what happened is these people were so frightened that pieces of their souls were just shooting out like a shotgun and sticking to other people and stuff. And then other people were picking up their stuff and whatnot. And so they just had this continuous mixing going on. Well, this lady came to a Nishaya seminar out here in New Mexico, and my wife and I were there. And we, we talked with her a bit and with a couple of her friends and stuff, and we did a soul retrieval for her. And she literally had thousands of little pieces from other people. And we were going and finding all those corresponding little pieces that she'd lost out there, too. And getting stuff back for her and getting the stuff to the spirits that would take it to the other people who had lost it. So a whole bunch of people were getting better out of that one soul retrieval. It was a good thing. But, you know, that's the thing. You know, those kind of cases, that's not too horrendous a deal. It's when you wind up going up against someone who is a conscious vampire, who knows how to steal energy, who knows how to defend themselves, who knows how to fight in the spirit realm. You know, or you go up against, you know, a gray man or one of the dark lords or something who have gotten into somebody's stuff. You know, then you're going to have a fight on your hands, and you're either going to live and win or you're going to die. You know, so it's a dangerous thing. You don't walk into a soul retrieval lightly.
No, I sure wouldn't. I know that.
So, you know,
I've heard of people, you know, that do that, and to me, it's got to be one of the most riskiest jobs there is.
Well, you know, I had 23 years of training before I was taught how to do soul retrievals.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way it should be. You should have a lot of training And I have worked with people who I worked with them for like 3, 4, 5 years, and the spirits came along and said, this person is here to do soul retrievals, teach them how to do it now. It's like, okay, that's one thing. But when someone, you know, a lot of people come and say, well, I want to learn how to do this, and it's like, well, okay, we'll talk to the spirits and we'll see what they say. And come back and say, well, you need to pursue this path for 25, 30, 40 years, and then you can learn. Or, no, you really shouldn't do this in this lifetime.
Yeah.
And they get angry and go away, and they find some shortcut to it, and they regret it. Now, a lot of times when they do stuff with people, you know, that sometimes they don't regret it. They're victims. The people that they are trying to do the soul retrievals for are the ones who regret it. If they either wind up with parts of someone else or some other spirit like we talked about, or they wind up, you know, basically just being deceived, and the person thinks that they imagine so-and-so in the spirit realm, and they sent so-and-so to them and all this sort of thing, and it's just an ego trip for the person, you know, supposedly doing the soul retrievals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, the soul retrievals are the way that you get people over it. But it needs to be done by someone who's truly qualified and trained to do it.
Yeah. Well, we have this one little old man that comes into town. He comes in about once a month. You know, and I know he's a psychic vampire because of the fact that, again, you know, he's his energy has been depleted, so he comes into town to feed. And he'll go, and of course, us store owners, you know, we're perfect for him because, you know, we can't run, you know. And so he'll come into town, and he'll go to every store, and he'll talk, and he'll complain about this, complain about that, da 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 da. And then he'll leave. And every one of the store owners, after he's gone, they are just so tired. You know, so weak.
So why do you choose to play in that?
Well, not me. I turned around. You know, the first time he came, you know, I didn't, you know, I thought, you know, maybe it was just me. Second time it happened again, I thought, ha ha, I know what this guy is. He's a psychic vampire. So what I did is I just kind of like, I did like a protection, you know, around me. You know, and out in front of my store, you know, of love, light, you know. And he never, after that, he has never come into my store. He'll go to every place else, but he won't come in here.
Well, there's another thing, too, that is good for people to do. You find it in the book of Hosea in the Jewish Bible. Hosea was, you know, they call the minor prophets. He wasn't a minor prophet. He was one tough dude in the spirit realm. And they call minor prophets because it's a small book. But Hosea had a wife named Gomer, and Gomer was a prostitute. And so she'd go off and, you know, and do stuff to people, and sometimes they'd take her as their slave. You know, it's like, hey, this gal's really good. She knows what she's doing. We're going to keep her. So Hosea was complaining to God about it. It's like, okay, you know, got this problem. What do I do about it? And God tells him, okay, you put this hedge of thorns around her. Now, this is not a hedge of thorns that he's gone and picked a bunch of rose bushes or something like that and made this this cage of thorns put around her. This is in the spirit realm.
Uh-huh.
The purpose of the hedge of thorns is to keep people out of relationships that they shouldn't be in.
Uh-huh.
In other words, if you have this hedge of thorns around you, the only way that someone can get into your energy is there's a karmic reason for them to be there.
Uh-huh. Well, this guy, if he sees me on the street, you know, you can see him down the street, and he'll just kind of like look at me real oddly, but he just kind of like walks around. He never says nothing, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Apparently, whatever I'm doing must be working, you know, because he definitely picked up on it and decided to stay away.
Yeah. You know, and people who are involved with the White Lodge and the Divine Hierarchy and stuff can call in the Masters and ask for, well, you know, like St. Germain's great. But, you know, ask St. Germain for the shield of protection.
Uh-huh.
And that shield will be there,
yeah.
And it will be there till the day you die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine that's what I'm probably putting around me, isn't it? A shield of protection.
Yeah.
But I have to call on Saint Germain by name.
you don't have to call a shit. You know, just Saint Germain is an example. There are lots of masters.
Uh huh.
You know, now if you don't know a particular master, hey, Saint Germain's a pretty good one. Sanat Kumara or whatever. It's just, you know, any master.
Well, what about a lot of people use the Archangel Michael?
Well, Archangels are fine, Chohans are fine, Mahatmas are fine. You know, anything out there that is on a level of mastery is fine. You know, there are a lot of people who will do something like, Mary, Mother of God, protect me or something, whatever. Uh-huh. You know, it works.
Yeah.
You know, those people are real. They're out there. They're doing their thing. You know.
Yeah. Unfortunately, people, because they can't see, they just don't believe. And these people are so real.
Yeah.
You know, and some people just don't get it. I was at the post office. I have to tell you this little story. I was at the post office the other day. There's a whole bunch of people in there, right? And there was like three windows there. And right at the same time, there was two people, one person at one window and another person at the other window, okay? So there was two windows there, and the people were standing there. And right at the same time, everything that they had sitting in front of them fell off onto the floor at the same time. And they picked it up, you know, didn't think anything of it. They just picked it up and just kept on talking. But neither one of them noticed that the other dropped theirs instantly, you know. And to me, and nobody else noticed it at all in that post office. And I noticed it, and I had to laugh because I knew that something, somebody was in there and did it.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, to say, here I am, or, you know, maybe as a joke, I don't know what it was. But I know it was a very deliberate thing. And I stood back and I had to laugh at it. Because for the fact that nobody got it. You know?
Yeah.
And it was so amazing, you know?
You know, sometimes spirits will do stuff like that as a joke, and sometimes they do it because they're trying to get somebody's attention.
Yeah. Well, I don't know why they did it, but I know that the possibilities of it, both of them dropping their stuff at the very same time off that counter, was just not there.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like, and to me, it told me so much, because people, they go about and they say, well, that stuff, you know, you can't, you know, the archangels, the spirits, you know, the energies, you know, the maybe the people from the other dimensions, you know, they're not there, you know, because I can't see it. But they don't realize how many times that they're actually trying to communicate.
Yeah.
But we're so numb and so into our own actions, we just don't see what's going on around us.
Yeah.
Oh. To me, it's amazing.
A lot of times there'll be spirits that will come along and they'll start doing things like people call it poltergeist activity, where they move stuff or knock stuff over or something. And a real simple thing to do is to put a piece of your awareness out in the spirit realm and say, okay, what is it that you need?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them that come to me that way are people who passed on and gotten stuck in this world, and they need a little help moving on.
Yeah.
Death Walker, they know it, and they come and make them their presence felt, and we talk with them and find out what the deal is and find out what it is we need to do to help them move on to where they need to be.
Yeah.
And then the activity stops.
Unfortunately, I'm so thick-skulled, I still don't get it. I get it to a certain point that I notice what they're doing, but I just can't, you know, understand them.
You know? Yeah.
Maybe eventually that'll come, you know, but as of yet it hasn't.
Well, do you have a guardian animal that you know of?
A guardian animal?
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Well, you have one, but obviously you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And what we can do is we can find out what your guardian animal is, and then you can start communicating with it. And the guardian animal does basically three things. It'll empower you, and it'll protect you, and it'll teach you. and you simply allow your awareness to go out within the spirit realm, and it'll take you places to show you stuff and do all kinds of things with you and stuff. And you can go with your guardian animal to, to help this person or this spirit or whatever to do what they need to do.
Okay, well, I can try that. Well, I teach people, you know, actually, maybe I do. I had a hypnosis one time, you know, to find my spirit guide. They says, well, look for, you know, you probably will see a bird. You know how they'll put message, you know, they'll try to coach you sometimes if they're not good. And anyhow, they says, well, you probably will see, what we want you to do is go and search for your spirit guide. He may come in the form of a deer or a bird or something like that. Well, I saw was a tall Indian, okay? Hey. And, bear, you know, waist adjusted. And, anyhow, with long black hair, and then is have like a, I don't know, some sort of a puff, you know, like at the top of the back of the head, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, but it was hair, like puffed up somehow, you know? But, and then like a long braid on one side, you know, of his hair. It was braided. But anyhow, standing on one side of him was a wolf, and then on the other side was a bear cub. Now,
well, let's talk about how you can find out for sure. Do you have a drum?
A drum?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Do you know somebody who does?
Well, I can get a drum.
Okay, you get your little hand drum or something, preferably made with, you know, hide or something. Get you a cassette player. You got one of those, you know.
Oh, yeah. We're using it now.
Yeah. We're using it right now. So what you do is you put your tape in and you drum at about, and you might need to practice first, you drum at a steady pace at about 120 beats per minute, like 2 beats per second.
Okay.
And you get to where you can do that for 7 minutes. And so you put the, you just beat steadily for 7 minutes. And then you do what's called a callback, where you will do 4 sets of 7 beats real fast. Just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, space. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, space. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, space. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then you're going to do a long set of 28 beats just as fast as you can. And then another 4 sets of 7. And when you're doing these 4 sets of 7, get to where you're a little bit slower each time. And at the end of that callback, then, well, we'll get to that. What you do is you lay down, you know, you rewind your tape, you lay down, and on your back, you have your legs straight, you're going to have your right arm down at your side and your left arm over your eyes. And this is an ecstatic trance posture that's been used worldwide for thousands and thousands of years to do what's known as a lower realm journey. See, we have, in the spirit realm, we have the lower realm, the middle realm, and the upper realm. The lower realm is the realm of the nature spirits. The middle realm is a mirror, if you will, of what's going on around us right now. And the upper realm is the realm of the other spirits other than the nature spirits. And each one of those has 13 dimensions in it, from the densest part of the earth out to the furthest edge of the cosmos. So, but we see it as circular. So it's like if you were to make a circle and cut it into a three-piece pie, and, you know, do one as the lower realm, one's the middle realm, one's the upper realm. If you go high enough in the upper realm, you're going to wind up in the lower realm and vice versa. And so, you know, it's not like there's anyone that's better than another and there's no heaven and no hell and stuff. It's just all circular. So, but you're going to be going to the lower realm. And being in this particular posture, on your back, legs straight, right arm at your side, left arm over your eyes, puts you in a position that facilitates you doing that. Now, at this point, it's kind of a visualizing thing. It's like,
do you have your head at a certain point, like pointing north or anything?
No, you have it on the ground.
Just any
just
position.
Lay down. Yeah, just lay down. If you feel like you want to do something on a polarity basis, then put your head either north or east. Like if you're doing body work on someone and you want the energy to flow right, then if you're north of the equator, you're going to have your head to either the north or the east. And if you're south of the equator, you're going to have it to the south or the west. And the energy is going to work better for the healing and stuff then. So if you feel like you need something like that, or and you can, then put your head to the north or the east.
Oh, okay.
If you can't, don't worry about it.
Okay.
Just lay down and get into posture. So then you start the tape with the drumming and stuff. And beforehand, you need to pick something that you're going to go through. Like when I was a little kid, there was this bur oak, which is a really tall oak tree that has these really big acorns on it.
Uh-huh.
I just loved those acorns because I could hold one in each hand, and I'd go up to my brother and my cousin, and invariably they'd do something, and I'd fall down and act like I was crying, and they'd be all confused and going, "We're sorry, Clifford, we didn't mean to do it, don't tell Granny." And I'd get up and nail them both when they got nice and close to those acorns and run for it. And they were so silly, I could do it to them about once a week and get away with it. It was great. But up on that bur oak also, there was this hole, and there was this little owl that lived in it. And I was always wanting to know what it looked like in there, but I couldn't climb up there. And so when I was going through this, my grandmother said, "Well, you've always been interested in that hole up there, so go through the hole, but don't dawdle. Just take a quick look around, and then go down through the tree and through its roots and stuff. And when you come out in the bottom, then you're going to come out in the realm of the nature spirits." Well, I figured a big old tree like this, man, that root's just going to be straight as it can be right down through the ground. Hits a rock, it goes around it, so you can kind of get a little whiplash spiritually. Or you pick something like a spring that you're going to go through, or a volcano if you're really into fire and stuff. A rabbit hole, whatever. Just pick a hole that's going to get you down into the ground, into the realm of the nature spirits. And so you go through this hole, and it won't take long, just a few seconds usually, and you're going to come out to the realm of the nature spirits. So when you get there, it's going to be your spirit that's there. You're going to know what's going on with your body. You're going to be totally aware of what's going on. That nobody can mess with it. It's not going to be a problem. It's safe. And so you get there, and you may be flying. Your spirit can fly, okay? It doesn't need to walk around on the ground unless you just want to. You might be underwater. That's okay, because your spirit doesn't need to breathe. Your body's doing that. You might be walking around on the land. Whatever the case, you start looking for animal spirits. And what you're looking for is the animal that comes to you four times first. We did this with a lady who's a zoologist in Arkansas. She saw the whole zoo. Sometimes, several times before she had an animal that came to her four times.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out to be a horse that she had in her pasture at home. but people need to be aware that it might not be what they expect it to be like. It might not be a wolf or a bear cub.
Uh-huh.
I had a lady who swore high and low that she was going to have a wolf.
Uh-huh.
And what happened is she went on her journey and was open to whatever happened, and she wound up with this giant sea turtle. She's scared to death of water.
Uh-huh.
You can get her in water, or own water, to save your life. Except take a shower or something. And so that was pretty interesting, because she had just opened up a business in Harrison, Arkansas, called Mona Lisa's Gallery. Now, Harrison is the national capital of the Ku Klux Klan, and they're about the most rabid of the right-wing Christians that there is.
Uh-huh.
And so she opens up this place called Mona Lisa's Gallery, honoring Mother Earth from the Cherokee perspective and stuff. They were after her. Well, she was going out on a little excursion with the Chamber of Commerce, and they wanted her to go out with them on this ski barge. And so she just trusted in her guardian, and out she went. And some members of the clan were along, and they threw her overboard and took the launch back into land and left her aground.
Really?
She was sinking, and she called me and told me about this. It was pretty neat. She was sinking, and she was just terrified, and next thing she knows, here comes her guardian swimming along, and it says, do what I do. So she was moving her arms and her legs and hands and stuff the same way that it was moving its flippers and stuff, and next thing you know, she was on the surface and headed for shore.
Huh.
Yeah. And these guys were going to jail. You know, so that was, you know, that was pretty neat. We had another lady down in Houston who, she's a Wiccan lady, and she's dynamite, maybe dynamite. And John just would drive in from Sealy, which is a little town right outside of Houston, into Houston to do her work. And there's all these wooded places along the way throughout Houston. And so as she was going along, she'd see all these foxes coming out looking at her. And she said, all I know of mine is it's a fox. I see them everywhere I go. And I'm like, no, John, just be cool and go with this process and, you know, and see what turns up. She says, well, okay, but I know it's a fox. And so she goes on her journey, and she goes to the first fox that she sees and says, here I am. And it's a, so he's like, well, you're my guardian. Oh, no. What do you mean, no? I see you everywhere I go. She says, oh, yeah, we watch you. We don't trust you.
Huh.
And he's like, huh, I guess I'd better get on with the process. Turns out it's Mandy Reister.
Oh, really?
Now, yeah. Now, real interesting thing, because she's paralegal, and at the time she was running, I mean, literally, she was running a law firm that had 8 attorneys and 32 paralegals. And, I mean, she ran them all like Mandy Reister.
Uh-huh.
She was not only the... She was all
so you say we mimic, somehow we mimic our guardian animal?
Oh, in many ways. We had a couple of folks up in Tahlequah who had been married for years and raised their kids and stuff, and they both got squirrels. Now, squirrels are really interesting. You know, squirrels, besides the fact that they're rats with furry tails, squirrels mate for life.
Uh-huh.
And they also go through this process where they'll have a cycle where they play, a cycle where they gather food and stuff, a cycle where they take care of their babies, and a cycle where they hibernate. And you could look at these folks' lives and see those cycles, those four cycles, continuously all the time. They had, you know, each little time set apart that they did these things.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you mimic them in some way.
Hmm.
And so they were really surprised, and it was pretty cool, and they were really, you know, thought it was pretty neat, because squirrels really do mate for life. And when one squirrel dies, the other one will do everything it can to kind of get it up and get going again and mourn it if it won't. And then they'll go on and they'll never mate again.
Huh.
So you kill a squirrel, guess what you're doing to somebody else.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of all those people that go out squirrel hunting not even realizing that they mate for life like that.
Yeah.
They just think, well, you know, they'll go on and mate with something else, but...
Yeah, they don't.
And then they wonder what happens to the squirrel population.
Yeah.
Hmm. Now, when you said that, you tape that, I'm assuming that what you do is you tape it, and then when you take it to the woods or wherever you're going to lay down at, then you just
take it to the woods.
Okay.
You're just going to lay down anyway. You can do it in the woods if you want to. You can do it in the living room. You can do it wherever you want to do it. It doesn't matter.
But the taping, you just play that tape back.
You play the tape so it's got the drumming. Now let's talk about the callback. You know, when your animal comes to you four times,
uh-huh,
then you accept its spirit to yourself, and you ask it to give you a name to call it by. Sometimes it will, sometimes it won't. And if it does, you see if you have permission to share that name with other people or not, because sometimes they'll say no.
Oh.
And you're the only one that calls it by that name, and you don't tell anybody else what its name is. You can tell them what it is,
uh-huh,
but you just can't tell them the name.
Uh-huh.
And so... you know, and you find out whatever information you can about, you know, like how to hook up with them, to do stuff and whatnot, and, you know, ways to honor them and things of that nature. But when the callback comes up, then by the time you get to the end of the callback, you need to be back in your physical body.
Uh-huh.
And you need to have that set intention. And, you know, because there are some people that the spirit room feels so good they just want to stay there.
Uh-huh.
They stay there too long and they have a dead body.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you stay there for 4 or 5 days. Hey, nobody was feeding and watering that body, and it's over.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a good thing to have someone there, so when it gets to the end of the callback, if you aren't back in your body and you aren't stirring around and stuff, then they can just reach it down and slap you on the bottom of the foot, you'll be back in your body so fast you won't know it hit you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and because anytime someone disturbs your body, you will get back in it in a hurry.
Yeah.
So that's a nice little safeguard. That's the callback force to get you to go back to your body. Then all you have to do is visualize your guardian animal and call it up, and your spirit can go wherever you want to go with it. You don't need that drum anymore. The drum's nice, but you don't have to have it. It's just an aid. And
uh-huh.
It kind of helps tie you into the heartbeat of Mother
Earth. Well, how do you leave again with your guardian animal?
Well, you just allow your spirit to go out, sit down someplace, or lay down someplace comfortable, and allow your spirit to go out and go wherever with it.
With the guardian animal.
With your guardian animal.
So you call the guardian animal to you, or you just leave and find it again?
Well, it's there with you.
All the time.
In fact, it's probably been there with you for several lifetimes.
Yeah. Huh.
And it's helping you get through your process. And so by going to it consciously, that's a good thing. You can do things that will strengthen your connection to that animal. You can have, you can wear clothes that have pictures of it on it, or have pictures or models of it around your house or something, or you can have paintings and stuff. What's really good is get you some videotapes, VHS tapes or CDs or something that show that animal in its natural state in physical life. And learn the way it moves, and then dance your animal, and invite your animal to dance with you and through you. See, they're not in a physical body anymore, and they still enjoy that physical sensation, and it's really neat to do, because what will happen is at first you might be a little kind of jerky and stuff, and maybe not real smooth, but you're doing what you can to mimic them, and then all of a sudden their spirit kind of comes in with you, and you just flow, and you just go with it until, you need to stop. And when you need to stop, it's not going to force the issue, because it's not there to hurt you, but, it likes it.
Huh.
And it's a good thing to do from time to time.
Huh.
And so that makes you more familiar with its energy. And what you're after in working with a guardian animal is getting to where you can see through that animal's eyes. And sense with its senses.
Uh huh. Almost like with the Highlander when the stag. Remember that movie,
yeah.
The Highlander?
Yeah, exactly.
He became one with the stag.
Right.
Yeah. The quickening, he called it.
Yeah. And that's a good way to view it, because that's about what it's like. My guardian is a gray wolf.
Uh huh.
And when I go out in the spirit realm, then I immediately manifest as wolf.
Uh-huh.
And go. And I can see so much better, and I can hear, and I can smell better. And if I tried to run like that in physical life, I'd collapse about a block away.
Yeah.
But I can just go and go and go and go in that wolf form.
Yeah.
A nice loping run that just lasts forever.
Now, why is it that it's an animal?
Well, I was asking the spirits about that one time, and they said, well, it's like this, the Jews got the order of creation right. The earth was created first, so the stones are guardians for the plants that were created second, and the plants are guardians for the animals who were created third, and the animals are our guardians, we were created fourth, and... I said, okay, and whose guardians are we? And they said, well, nobody's. I said, and why not? Other things haven't been created yet? I said, well, actually, other things have been created. I said, okay, how long did it take for the stones and the plants and the animals to get to be where they could be guardians for others? And they said, about 100,000 years.
So,
and I asked them about, okay, well, humans, since the first humans began and the first green race and stuff, how long have we been at it? They said, well, about 1.5 million years. And I said, and at our current rate, how long do we have to go before we become guardians for something else? And they said, well, at the current rate, the human race is going about 1 million years, which isn't real cool, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the neat thing is that was when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, things have been speeding up so fast, and now we've had, you know, like 58.9% of the Earth choose a higher spiritual path.
Yeah.
I think it just got a little faster.
Yeah, really.
You know, so, you know, the day is going to come when we're going to be somebody else's guardian.
Okay, so now where does the fairies come into this?
Well, the fairies are not human.
Uh-huh.
In fact, they don't even look human if you want to see them in a real form. And they're all different sizes of fairies, from the tiny little pixies that are, you know, sort of a cross between, a little flying bug, you know, like sort of a cross between a mayfly as far as their wings in a slightly human form, up to the banshees.
Uh-huh.
You know, and banshees are some pretty ferocious stuff.
Yeah.
And they wander around more in dimensions that are neighbored to this one than in our dimension. They used to be in our dimension a lot, but basically they just really got tired of humans.
Yeah, I don't blame them. But they're like the guardian of the forest and that, right? The plant, the guardian of the plants and that?
Guardians of the earth in general.
Yeah.
They are, it's like, you know, the ones that are the more higher ranking are the devas.
Yeah.
You know, I see this stuff, you know, where, you know, someone says, well, you know, I'm the shopping deva or something like that. Well, you can't be a human and be a deva. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah. It's, you know, it doesn't work. And so, you know, they are, you know, that's kind of like the royalty of the fairies.
Uh-huh.
Now, people think that fairies are such, you know, nice, fluffy, frou-frou things, and that's the way they like to picture them and stuff. Got a little news for you. A fairy's favorite food is raw human flesh.
Really?
And they can pick your bones clean so fast that your bones would be standing there before they have a chance to fall with all the meat gone.
Mm.
You know, so, if you're ever in a place where you hear that maybe there's this fairy treasure at a certain place or something,
uh-huh,
leave it alone.
Yeah.
Don't irritate them.
Well, you know, like our enchanted forest here, you know, I've actually taken pictures of them. You know, the sprites, the tree, what are they called? The tree gnomes, I think that they're called. We've got pictures of the divas, but they haven't never harmed me. I can't see them. You know, I mean, what they do is they camouflage themselves. You know, they just get so perfectly still and they camouflage themselves. But if you're really looking good in the pictures, you can see them.
They will actually make alliances with people, and you make alliances with them just like you do with little people.
Yeah.
You know, put something sweet out there for them and let them know it's for them and invite them to be involved in your life.
Well, I always do. I always grow up. Now, you know, it used to be that I used to just once in a while take tobacco out, but now I always take out tobacco anytime I go into the forest.
Yeah, well, take them some tobacco, take them a little candy or something like that, some marshmallows.
Yeah, I was thinking about taking them some nuts. What do you think of nuts?
Well, they've got all the nuts they want. They're out there in the streets.
So they want the sweet.
They've got other nuts, too. There are humans running around here. Kind of crazy.
Well, maybe. So you're saying, like, that sugar candy, something
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they like that sweet stuff, and the tobacco is good, too.
Okay. Yeah, so they're okay. So now we've covered. Let's see. There was something else. Oh, gotta ask this. It, you know, I wanted to do this on my own, okay, without just asking you. And I've spent just going through all these books on the website. I've lost part of my vision over this. Who are the Mound Builders?
Well, you know, the Mound Builders are the serpent tribes.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the taboo.
Okay, so because somebody told me that the last photos that I started taking at this one special place, it's called the Mormons look at it as for he, and they said that it's a sacred area. You know, it's a veiled city. It's a place of the gathering during the end times. The Mormons are all supposed to go back there, you know. But anyhow, I went back there in that area, and I shot, and I got a bleed through in the sky. You know, it was night, you know, but there was a bleed through, and I swear it's a temple that is showing up. I mean, it even has the engravings on the stone. You can actually see the engravings, you know, and I'm shooting up into a sky, you know, above the power lines, and I mean, this thing is coming through just as clear as can. Well, so clear I can actually see the engravings on the stone, you know.
Well, yeah, you can go to a lot of places that are real, real major power points in the earth, like Sedona, you know, places like that.
Yeah.
And take pictures and have other things appear. Or sometimes, if you're sitting, you're just kind of in a dreamy state, and you're not really focused on some specific thing that you're concentrating on.
Yeah.
You can see whole cities and stuff there. In the spirit realm that people don't see physically anymore.
Well, I'm thinking that, you know, I've looked at various pictures, you know, trying to compare the photos that I have, with ancient, structures, and it just seems to me that I'm looking at what possibly maybe was, you know, earlier than Egyptian, you know. I'm feeling Lemurian there, and
well,
you know,
if you run around the Pacific Islands, for example,
yeah,
you will find a lot of stuff there. There are open air temples, in other words, they don't have a roof. They may have walls and stuff like that, but they don't have a roof.
Yeah,
you know, and those are the ancient temples of Mu, which far predate the Egyptian stuff.
Yeah. Well, these pictures I'm getting, they're actually even in color. I mean, you know, the stones, I mean, you know, they're like a sandstone, and then there's red in it and green in it, you know, and it's like, I mean, my gosh, it's just amazing, those photos that I'm getting in it. And that's what I'm going with, too, is that the mound builders were, you know, the ancient ones of Mu, you know. But anyhow,
well,
I just needed to ask that of you, to make sure that I was going in the right, you know, direction with this.
Well, the Sedaha have always sent out missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what they call the missionaries?
What?
Mayans.
Mayans?
Yeah, you know, Mayan simply means missionary.
Uh-huh.
You know, anyway, they weren't like missionaries in Christianity or Islam or something where you believe like we believe or we're going to kill you.
Uh-huh. They were teachers.
You know, they were.
Okay, so, and that's where the legends of the great white prophet comes from, right?
Well, that's where it originally came from, and that individual ran around this country about 500 years before, starting about 500 years before. The one that we know is Jesus did his thing.
Yeah.
Taught the exact same things and stuff, but he was running around over here. Started in Peru, worked up all through the country and stuff.
Okay, so that's good. I'm glad, because I don't want to put my book out until I did correct that website too, by the way,
okay,
that you asked. Okay, I think I got it right now. And so, anyhow, we've spoken on the guardian animals, the fairies, the psychic vampires. I'm going to take us right back again, okay, to where did the legend of Dracula come from?
Well, Bram Stoker, who wrote the story of Dracula, wasn't the first one to come up with it.
Right.
And that was a legend that had been around, Transylvania for hundreds and even thousands of years. And the entity that is, you know, that Dracula portrays, you know, does indeed go back to the Sumerians and stuff. And if you, you know,
to Dagon?
Yeah, to Dagon, yeah. But,
it's amazing what you can find, catch out of a movie or a comic book now and then, right?
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of that stuff is really based on fact. And a lot of times, even if it's not, you know, they might not even intend it to be based on fact.
Yeah.
But the people who write this stuff, whether it's Blade or The Matrix or, you know, Star Wars or whatever and stuff, a lot of times they are channeling stuff from the spirit realm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's stuff that's lost knowledge. It's occult information, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be reinstituted into society to deal with the things that are going on. And if you don't know where something comes from, you don't know how to get rid of it or work with it or whatever you need to do.
Yeah. Okay, but is that where it started with the Dagons then? Now, the Dagons aren't the Nomals or anything. They're not the Nomals, right?
No, it didn't start with the Dagons.
Okay.
That's where what eventually became known as Dracula started. But that's where the idea of a vampire that runs around sucking blood started. There were vampires that did that. There, in fact, there are. There's a vampire cult, for example, in New Orleans. They have a vampire church there.
But they're not real vampires. Do you really think that there's not really such a thing as a vampire today?
Some of them are. Some of them aren't.
Really?
There are a whole bunch of people who go to that church who are wannabes.
Uh-huh.
You know, like people who go to police bars who want to be cops, but they don't have what it takes. And then there are, you know, there are some that are around there that, you know, they really are. You know. But
they're immortal as well?
They're not really immortal. They can get to the point where they don't get their fix just like any other addict, and they die.
Uh-huh.
You know,
but they have to have the blood in order to live.
Yeah, and they're not really after the blood so much. You know, there are very few vampires that you'll ever find that require blood. They just require energy.
Oh, okay. So the real true vampire then is the psychic
vampire.
Is the psychic vampire.
Yeah, the blood. You know, it's like. There's a saying in the Christian Bible, and this is where the idea of the blood came from, where it talks about blood, saying you shouldn't eat blood because the life is in the blood.
Uh-huh.
Well, the energy is really, you know, in its freest flowing form, is in the blood. And what do you think you have in the hepatic soul? The liver stores blood.
Oh, okay.
Stores and cleanses blood. So that's where the energy's at.
Uh-huh.
Now, so the blood then is a physical archetype, if you will, for energy.
Uh-huh.
They're after the energy.
Oh, I see.
The people who are wannabe vampires and stuff, they run around and they'll get blood from a butcher and all this sort of stuff, or maybe if they're really lucky, someone manages to steal some from a blood bank or something, and they'll drink the blood. You know what usually happens?
They get sick.
Yeah, they deserve it. but real vampires and stuff are the ones that are going after that psychic energy. You know, if they do something like a Ravenwalker, like the one we talked about, Spearfinger, where they actually eat somebody's liver and stuff, yeah, they'll get all that sort of stuff, and they'll also get a physical reaction from it that's not real good. And that kind of brings up another thing. That's why traditional Cherokees do not donate organs.
Uh-huh.
If someone takes an organ of mine when I die and they put it in someone else, I guarantee you I will come back and haunt them.
Uh-huh.
You know, that might not be a nice thing to say, but that's just the way I feel about it. It's like, you know, I will make your life miserable if you do this to me. Because what you do is you take a big chunk of somebody's energy and you put it in someone else. And it's bad for the person who's passed on because they still need that energy in the spirit realm, okay?
Uh-huh.
And it's also bad for the person who receives it, even though they say, oh, but it saved their life. Well, it didn't save their life because their life changed drastically. You will not find anyone who has gone through an organ transplant whose personality has not changed.
Yeah. Well, I've heard of people that's had the transplants that's actually had memories of that other person
that's right,
the original donor.
Uh-huh. Because they aren't themselves anymore.
Okay, here's another one that confuses me, and it sticks with the same subject, and that is cremation. Now,
that's the way to go. Right
there. Now, some people say that that's not the way to go because it destroys the soul.
No, it doesn't. You see, the souls die with the body. It's the spirit that lives on it eternally.
Uh-huh.
And the two great cleansers are fire and water.
Uh-huh.
So if you're in releasers of energy. So if you cremate someone, then all of their energy is released, and there's usually a residual bit left in the ashes. If you take the ashes and you dump them into nice flowing water and stuff, that releases any residuals that are left. It's all gone.
Well, now, what is this about, like the Egyptians, they're supposed to be so smart about all this, but the Egyptians would have it, they would mummify the bodies, but they take out the organs and put them in.
Let's take it from a different viewpoint here. How many Egyptians do you think have lived over the millennia?
Well, a few.
Yeah, millions.
Yeah.
How many of them were embalmed?
Just the high priests, or just the pharaohs and the royal family.
The royal family and the hierophants and their servants. That's it.
Yeah.
And the hierophants were the leaders of the mystery cults. And the reason that they did it is because they knew that they were going to come back to serve their people again, and they wanted to have the continuity of energy from that time to the life that they came back in. You know, they were already a very high, refined energy. Now, see, personally, I don't plan on coming back to this earth again when I'm through with this life.
Uh-huh.
I have no intention of coming back. You know, I'm really quite fed up with it all.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just as honest as I can be. I've had quite enough of human life.
Yeah, I hear you.
And so when this lifetime is over with, I want to be cremated because I don't want any of my energy left here. I am not coming back.
So if you're cremated, you can never come back?
Oh, you can come back, but you don't have to. And if you have no intention of coming back, then why do you want any of your energy to be left here?
So by the mummification,
it holds a part of the person's energy at that time, and so they can actually come back to another physical life and reconnect with that energy and have an understanding and a continuity of everything from that previous lifetime to their current lifetime so that they know how to work with the people that they're here to serve.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Well, how come they turn around and put the organs in other vessels, though?
How they turn around and put the organs in other people or something?
In other vessels, you know, in vases or
urns. Well, it's a way of containing the energy.
Okay. Because each one holds a different energy.
Yeah.
Huh. It gets gosh darn confusing to me, I'll tell you. And then it's like after the spirit doesn't leave the... Now, the spirit should leave the body immediately, right? Well, what?
No,
then why do they talk about...
20 minutes.
20 minutes? Well, what's everybody talking about 3 days for?
Dead, it takes about 20 minutes for them to completely leave the body. That's why when someone passes on, you do not want to let them move that body out of the hospital room quickly.
Uh-huh.
Because what it'll do is the spirit will kind of come out a little bit, and then it'll come back kind of looking for its body, and sometimes it kind of get lost and wander around, but you can do things to release them from that body.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a type of ritual known as the Bardot.
Uh-huh.
A real good way to learn about Bardot is through... an outfit called Astara out in California.
And how do you spell that, Bardot?
Yes, Bardot is B-A-R-D-O.
Okay.
And there are Wiccan rituals, for example, that deal with the Bardot and how to release the dead, stuff on death walking and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
There are you get stuff in the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the Tibetan Book of the Dead that have rituals on how to help someone transition. Basically, you have what's called seed atoms, and you have one that's in the top of the heart, one that is essentially the third eye and stuff, and one that's in the crown.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so you have the third eye, the heart, the diaphragm. The diaphragm releases first, the third eye releases second, the heart seed atom is the one that releases last.
Uh-huh.
Now, when that goes, then, yeah, it really is over, but it takes usually about 20 minutes. You can do things like with flower essences, for example. Paralandra has some great flower essences, for example. And you can use those to release someone a little more quickly. In fact, you can take flower essences and prepare a combination of essences for someone for that release, and then you can just simply, you can just put it on, on their forehead, and put some just right below the, the sternal notch, over where would be the top of the heart and on the diaphragm and stuff,
mm-hmm.
At the solar plexus, and just let them go. I mean, that energy from those flower essences are designed for that person for the purpose of simply getting them out of their body in a hurry, because, there are a lot of times when someone dies in the hospital, man, they want them out of there in a hurry.
Yeah.
They don't want anybody seeing that dead body. That means that hospital failed as far as they're concerned. And they also want to get you out of there so that they can get another body in.
Yeah, right.
Now,
what is this about 3 days? You have to wait 3 days.
That's for the judgment. Now, that there are one of the things that happens when someone passes on is, and we like to coach them through it, like that about 5 minutes, at their passing, we'll tell them, you are coming into the presence of a clear white light. See if you can grasp that light and take it into yourself. Because if they can, then they'll never come back to this earth again. They'll go straight into mastery.
Uh-huh.
And then if they can't, there's going to be about 5 minutes later, there's going to be this denser white light. And that you can really, you can physically see.
Uh-huh.
And if they can embrace that, then they'll go into, the Highlands or the Summerlin, which is a place in the spirit realm where you're prepared for mastery in your next life.
Uh-huh.
And then if they, and if they can't do that, then it's going to take about another 10 minutes to get them out of their body.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you can, once they do get out of their body, then if they were not able to embrace that white light,
uh-huh.
then they're going to go through a transition period, and that's the 3 days. And in that transition period, they will basically be taken to a place in the spirit realm, and that's known as the Midlands, and they will be essentially like unconscious, and there will be masters who work with them to help them make the transition and help them to remember the laws of the spirit realm that they may have forgotten and stuff during their time in the earth. And then at the end of that 3 days, then they will go through the judgment.
Uh-huh.
But the judgment isn't what it's portrayed in most religions and stuff. It's not God, sending you to heaven or hell and may you burn for freaking eternity or something. What it is having been made aware of those spiritual laws, you then are placed in a review of the lifetime that you have just lived to see how well you did innately, either living by those laws or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is you have a couple of masters who will be there with you, whether it's from your tradition or some other tradition, there'll be a couple of masters who are there with you to try and help you temper your judgment of yourself.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because we're most critical of our own selves.
Exactly. And there's no difference there. I mean, you're still yourself there.
Uh-huh.
Only then you're aware of all the laws in the spirit realm and how well you did or didn't do. And so they're there to say, look, okay, you did so much better than in this previous lifetime or something like that. They're really nice about it.
Uh-huh.
So that's the 3 days. And then, if you're able to embrace that white light, you go straight to the judgment and on to your next lessons.
So if the body is destroyed before 3 days, it's still okay, right? Because your spirit's not,
right.
Your spirit or soul's not in your body.
Yeah, your spirit's not in it.
Okay. Exactly.
You know, your souls are released and stuff that with the body, but your spirit's eternal. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you have, if you want to really get down to it, you have one life, and that life goes through transitions, and it goes through death. That's all death is transition.
Uh-huh.
And there'll be, it'll have, you know, its life will take on a physical form, then it'll release that physical form, it'll take on another physical form and release that physical form and so forth. But your spirit's just going on, man. It's moving, you know.
Yeah.
It never dies.
Yeah. Well, I think we had a very interesting show tonight, don't you?
Yeah, it was good.
I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. And, you know, and we needed to, I think we needed to cover some of this, you know, because there's just a, you know, it's like you said, there's so much more than just the physical in the healing process. Because, I mean, we're all going for something other than just getting through the next few years. So it's a healing of our soul. You know, so that when the transition takes place, you know, we can be the best that we can be, you know, understand.
Yeah.
And the only way we can do that is by understanding, you know, what the laws are and how nature works, what to know about, what to be aware of, you know, various things like that. And we're speaking with Sir Clifford, our favorite guest. That I shouldn't say guest, because actually Clifford's got his own show here with us, the Cherokee Medicine Way, and you can hear it every Sunday night from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock. And after that, we put it on our on-demand site at BurlingtonNews.net under the Cherokee Medicine Way. He has a special place that is just for him alone, and then that's where you want to go to, you know, to find his shows. And soon, when I get the time, what I'm going to do is combine all of his shows, and then they'll be for sale, you know, as like a volume, you know, that you can actually purchase if you want the volume, or you can just buy one CD at a time. And all that money goes to Clifford in our way of trying to help further his work and trying to salvage. Trying to bring, I don't know if I should say salvage, but to help you guys to learn again the old ways, because the old ways are the best ways as far as I'm concerned. So anyhow, we want to thank Clifford. You can now go to his website at nasinc.org. That's N as in Nancy, ASSINC.org. Or you can find it at BurlingtonNews.net. The link's right there, and you can just click on it and go to Clifford's site. And don't forget, if you want to help further the cause, send your donations over to Clifford. You can find out how to go about doing this, where to send it, by going to his website. And thank you so much, Clifford. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And God bless you. Or, you know, Luke Skywalker say?
May the force be with you.
May the force be with you.
Yeah.
Okay, you take care now. Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye.